I am a ladder burner. I choose purpose over power, collective advancement over solo achievements. I am highly motivated. I know what I bring to the table has impact in my community. I am bolder, faster, and freer because my soul defines me, not my status.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to Ladder Burners Unite. I'm your host, Alan Patterson, and today we have the privilege of listening to Dan Castle. This is our first recommendation from a recommendation. Steve Hart, who's at the University of Pennsylvania, had recommended that we speak with Diana Walters, which we did. So we've interviewed Steve and Diana, and she suggested that our person today, Dan Castle, would be interesting to talk to. And that is an understatement. Dan has a really wide career. He has both technical chops. He's worked in several organizations, IT related. And he also has a degree, a master's of philosophy in organizational dynamics. I call him a right brain engineer, as I do so many of the clients I was fortunate to work with. So prepare yourself for a really interesting discussion as you hear from Dan Castle.
The paradox for me is I've studied organizations for probably 10 years of my life. I've been in an organization for almost 30, if you look at the corporate world. Sure. And the more I know, the less I'm fascinating, regardless of the outcome, because it just reminds me that there's just so much more to learn and there's always more to do and more to understand.
It's great. It's a great attitude, and it's a great way to think about it. The debilitating part can be overwhelming.
Absolutely.
Since that sometimes for myself. Prior to coming to Penn, who were you? Where'd you live? What'd you do?
It's a great question, and I'll answer it. But as way of introducing that, I have four children myself today. They're four teenagers, and I'll get to that as I catch back up with the story. But I always tell them, you need to be prepared to answer that question. I grew up in Hoboken, New Jersey, in the mid-70s. If you're familiar with Hoboken, it's a tiny little square mile town known for three things. The birthplace of baseball, Frank Sinatra, and I would say one of the best pieces to get fresh mozzarella cheese, if that's the thing that you're into.
Say no more.
There's other things too, but my parents were blue-collar people. My dad was a carpenter and a fireman in the city of Hoboken. My mom was a homemaker. I was the middle of three kids, went to a public grammar school, by all means had an average middle-class life. My father splurged when I went to high school because I had an interest in going to high school at a place in New York City called Xavier. And that to me was, now mind you, high school being very formative, right? One of the most formative times in my life. It really changed my perspective on pretty much everything. And I think set me on the path that I started out with at the age of 18. And I get a scholarship to college because there's no way I have money to go to college. So I get a scholarship to go to college. I was pursuing an appointment to West Point, having gone through the Army JROTC program. Had a choice to go to West Point, had a choice to go to this Catholic Jesuit university named St. Peter's in Jersey City. And both of them were free at that point. I had no tuition obligation for college. So I said, in my simplistic mind at 17, I was like, spend 4 years in school and owe nothing to anybody, or spend 4 years in school, get commissioned, and owe 7 years to the U.S. government. So the choice that I made was to go to St. Peter's. Continued my education in philosophy and cognitive psychology, which is an interesting sort of area. And I finished with a dual major because I had a four-year scholarship and I had finished my psych degree in 3.5 years. And the school said, look, you still have another semester worth of tuition. Is there anything else you're interested in studying? And I said, well, yeah, every time I've gone to a psych class, I've learned about how psych and philosophy were the same. And then they branched off. So I said, well, what would it take for me to get another major in philosophy? They said, you'd have to take 24 credits. I said, okay. So I took 18 credits during the day and 6 credits at night, my final semester. And I finished with a double major in psychology and philosophy. I finished my degree and I wind up getting a job in Manhattan. This is 1997. And I get a job in a technology area. And you say, well, Dan, how are you qualified for that? And the honest answer was I wasn't, right? But this is where the stuff that's in your book begins to really resonate with me. Because it never occurred to me that I couldn't do it. No one ever told me you can't do that job. I was simply In my life, Alan, I've got a list of things I've done and a list of things I haven't done yet. There is no cannot do. And if there was, I would put maybe ballroom dancing and juggling. So I get this job in technology largely because I know the guy who works there, because I was the lifeguard at the pool at St. Peter's. And this guy would always come in 10 minutes before closing, and I'd always let him stay 10 minutes after closing. So the value of networking to me starts really early on. One job begets another. I find myself at Sun Microsystems in late 2000. Now, Sun, if you recall, was the sort of darling of the internet ball, right? We used to say that if you had money and you had a business plan, you bought Sun, and Sun printed money. I joined Sun at the age of 20. I had almost $1.3 million worth of stock options on paper. I would see no penny of that, by the way, at some point. Because one bright Tuesday morning, I go to work at Sun in September of 2000. And what I haven't told you is Sun's offices are on the 26th floor of 2 World Trade Center. So you know the drill. From there, obviously, I escaped that building. I managed to escape that building with just enough time to see the plane fly over my head that hits 2 World Trade Center. And that day is an absolute train wreck, as you can imagine. And what I later come to understand is the people in my life, I just was married 18 months ago, prior to that, to my college sweetheart, who I'm still married to today, 23 years later. And I realized they suffered far more than I did. Because I knew I was fine, but I couldn't communicate that to anyone. I spend the next 3 or 4 years putzing around New York City. I get stranded there again in the blackout of 2002, 2003, until I finally realize, you know what? This is not the life that I want. I don't want to keep chasing the next thing. I enjoyed my time in New York City. The economy is different. Gosh, I'm glad to be alive. I have no kids. We were pursuing this different path of make as much money as possible and just travel the world, do our thing. We're charitable people, we're religious people. So in 2004, I move jobs and I move homes, bringing me to where I am today in Southern New Jersey. And I go to work for BlackRock, right? Very small at that time, right? Hard to imagine BlackRock being small, but very small, 4,000 person company. I become one of the first people that works in technology in the state of Delaware for BlackRock. I cut my teeth at BlackRock over the next 12 years. I do a multitude of jobs. I start out as an individual contributor. Within 6 months, I get called to New York City from my boss to meet with my boss. I said, okay, what do you got? We have this team that's struggling to maintain the operation that we need to manage this platform that manages all this money. And I want you to lead that team. And I said, I've never done that before. I've always been an individual contributor. I've worked in this tech area. I'm willing to give you a shot. And I said, fine. How about I do it for 6 months? And at the end of 6 months, if I don't like it or I'm not doing it well, you move me back to where I was. No harm, no foul. He says, sure. I do that job for 6 years, and I manage that team from 12 people to 110 people through two mergers and acquisitions. And it's my first chance to lead not only a large team, but a large global team with members of my team in 11 different countries and 6 different time zones. At that time, my first son, Matthew, is born. So we're a young family. My wife and I are like, hey, this is great. We've got a new home, sort of new life. We've gotten away from some of the trauma physically and emotionally that was caused. We've got a new family. Everything's going swimmingly well. Let's have another kid, right? Famous story. So 2 years goes by, my wife and I say, let's have another child. We were very successful at that. Very successful at that. Because in 2008, we welcomed triplets into our world.
Get out.
Yep. So now in 2008, I'm like, I've gone from one kid to 4 kids. I've got this large international team. We just did a merger at BlackRock with Merrill Lynch Investment Managers. I'm traveling the world. I spend 6 or 8 weeks out of the country the year that my triplets were born and my oldest is 2 years old. I have this epiphany that for me, and this only comes afterwards. I'm in the right spot at that moment in my life because I needed to provide financially for my family. I hit the wall, right, with BlackRock in 2016. I decide, this isn't for me anymore. I've spent my entire life in finance. Let me go do something different. So I go to work for Cigna. And from 2016 to 2019, I work at Cigna in a similar field, but a different healthcare, a different vertical. And I hated every minute of it. It was just not a good cultural fit for me.
What was the disconnect?
I think part of it, Alan, was I was considered a remote employee. What I learned at BlackRock is being in Delaware with BlackRock's headquarters in New York, I was always second fiddle. Right. I was never going to make it, whatever that meant to me at the time, which was really around promotion. I was never going to be promoted because I wasn't in the home office. Even though once a week for 12 years, I got up at 4:45 a.m., drove to 30th Street, Philadelphia, got on that train, sat at my desk in Manhattan at 7:50 a.m. before the people that lived in Manhattan even got there, worked the full day till 6 o'clock, and then got on the train and came home. Because I was chasing the dollar. I was climbing that ladder in the terms of your book. Partly because I didn't know any better. and partly because that's what I thought I was supposed to do. But my conscience, going back to the cognitive psych and the philosophy piece, got the best of me. And I said, there's got to be more to life. Like, I wasn't spared, and I used that term on 9/11 for this. Like, it's not just about making my boss happy, because that's, by the way, impossible for anybody who thinks otherwise. I was making myself miserable, and it was starting to make my family life miserable at the same time. While I was at Sun, the piece I glazed over was Sun paid for, had an education benefit. So I went to Stevens in Hoboken, finished a master's in information systems while I was at Stevens. Is like the one thing, and I tell my kids this, the one thing that I believed very early on is that no matter what happens in a job, the thing that a company can never take away from you is your attitude, your experience, and your education. And so for me, anybody who ever offered tuition, I took it. While I'm at Cigna, Cigna offers a tuition benefit. And I said, hey, this is great. I'm going to go back to school again. I already have a master's degree at this point from Stevens. I really wasn't interested at the time in a doctoral degree. So I look at Penn, which is about a half hour away from where I live today, and they've got this interesting program called Organizational Dynamics. And the more I read about it and the more I think about it, this is like the perfect union of what I studied as an undergraduate, what I studied as a graduate, and really my work experience, having gone from an individual contributor to this global leader with no training and figuring it out on the job. I finished my Penn degree, an MPhil in Organizational Dynamics in December of 2020. I'm at a company called Tanium, which is a technology company. They're a startup. This roller coaster ride has hit a dip and it's on the accelerator again. But as I soon find out in January of 2021, it declines again. I wake up on a Thursday morning. I cannot feel the right side of my body. I rush myself to the hospital. It turns out I have a stroke. I'm sitting in the ER of this hospital 3 years ago this month. And I'm like, how in the world did this happen? Did I push myself too hard? Is this the reason that I'm here? The same day, Alan, that I'm laying in that bed, the company I'm working for decides that my department is no longer critical to their function, and they eliminate my entire department. So I'm sitting in ICU in a hospital, January of 2021, no idea what's happening to me, no idea if I even have a job to pay for what is becoming like a huge medical crisis. And that's my second epiphany, which is, why am I doing this again? What's the point? Why do I continue to take on all this work? And what am I chasing at the end of the day? What am I trying to get to? Fast forward 6 months, they figure out what the cause of my stroke was. It turns out to be a genetic abnormality I was born with that I never knew I had. I'm on my knees again, praying to my God and saying, I made it through 9/11. I made it through four kids, including triplets, and my wife did without issue. Now I've survived a stroke. What do you want from me? What is my purpose here? What am I here for? Why am I still here after all these things? I haven't answered that question yet, by the way, but I keep looking for it. And so I take another job because my job has now been eliminated. It's not the union of what I love, what I feel like I'm born to do, and where I can make a living. I think I know where that is yet, but I'm not quite there yet. But in the meantime, my relationship with my wife improves dramatically because I'm spending more time at home. My relationship with my kids improves dramatically. And I think that's where I'm at today. So I've got a nearly 18-year-old son and 16-year-old who will be 16-year-old triplets. When I read your book, Alan, what I think about is not only is it about meaning and purpose for all the reasons I just relayed to you, but I think it's timely and timeless at the same time. And I want to give this book to my kids, because especially my older son, who's about to embark in his own life to figure out what he wants to do. And you ask him, what do you want to do for a living? He says, I want to make a lot of money. I'm like, oh, God help me. Like, how do I not teach you the same things that I've been through in my own life? That's not what it's about. I've had some great runs. I'm not saying I acknowledge it's a luxury that not everybody may be in the position the same way that I am. But I think I'm fortunate that I've recognized it. And I think I'm fortunate that I can express that at least to my kids and to the students that I work with at Penn in the classroom. Long answer to your question, but I hope that gives you a perspective of who Dan is and how I got to be where I am today, and perhaps why Diana thought you and I would be a good chat to have together.
What makes you think you haven't gotten there yet?
I don't know that there is a there. I really do think that my purpose, Alan, may have nothing to do with me, but may have something to do with one of my kids. That my kids are destined to do something revolutionary. And that my purpose in still being here is to be there for them and to help coach and mentor. And I'm on a continuous spiritual journey. So I'm continuing to study. I'm a Catholic. I converted to Catholicism in college away from Lutheranism, largely on the back of the work that I learned from the Jesuits at Xavier High School and at St. Peter's. let me formulate a hypothesis and let me test it. Let me figure out if what I think is right about the world isn't, except in this case, the world is me. I always say it's an N equals one study. I don't know what I want to be when I grow up. My kids ask me that all the time. Dad, are you happy with what you're doing? I'm like, today? Sure. In the moment? Maybe not. In the grand scheme of things, I've never looked at work. And this is the other kick I'm on lately. I've never looked at work as part of my identity. And I think that for all too many people, especially in our country, work is a big part of who they are.
No doubt. Right?
To go back to what we talked about earlier, like if we had met in person completely randomly, most Alans or Dans probably would have started out by saying, oh, hey, Alan, I'm Dan. Hey, Dan, I'm Alan. What do you do for a living? That's the first question we always ask each other. And for me, like, I could care less what people do for a living. I'm interested in people for people. Tell me something different about you. Tell me something unique about you. Tell me why, this is not you, Alan, but generically, tell me why I want to invest my time to get to know you. I don't see that as all too common today. And it worries me because I think I understand the reason for it. Again, having watched my kids grow up, the way social media has engineered an endorphin and a dopamine hit, the way people don't value relationships, they don't take the time to invest in them. There's no resilience building in kids anymore. What worries me is like, what world is ahead for the next 20 or 30 years? And what's one thing I can do today to make a difference, to make a dent? And that's, I go back to my kids, I go back to the students that I'm privileged to work with at Penn. And I try to just influence them and say, look, the path is not predestined. It doesn't have to be, I think, again, in your words, it doesn't have to be up. It can be across. And if you don't know, go back to Yogi Berra, if you see a fork in the road, take it. If you don't know what you want, that's part of the problem. And you've got to sit in silence and be thinking about what is it that I want in this life? What is it that I want out of my career? What is it that I want to do? Because otherwise you just get pushed around and you just go with the flow. And I don't think that leads to people that are content. They may be financially happy, but I don't think they're happy at the end of the day.
I think it's important to ponder is, what am I looking for, or what's driving me? And my elder years have begun to think that's not really the question, that if you truly believe that the joy and meaning comes through connection, then don't need to worry about where you'll be. You talk about your children, you're their father, and you could wear a lot of ribbons on your chest there from what your experience has been. The opportunity for what they get from you, and I imagine your wife, it's not a single experience. They see a bridge that other people don't.
So as a Catholic, I would call that providence. And I've reflected on that quite a bit. I've reflected on that.
Yeah.
Go back to the 9/11 story. I registered for a conference that was at the 110th floor of One World Trade that day. It was
a conference
on the use of technology in financial services. That was the vertical that I covered at Sun Microsystems. But I registered for that conference too late and I wasn't allowed in. It's hard not to think about that as a providential movement or
no doubt
in my own life. I evacuated that building on the 26th floor because I was told to. And when I got to about the 11th floor, the announcement came over the PA system. I still remember this clearly, saying, please go back upstairs. But in the moment, it was the right thing to do because my building was not yet struck. They had another building that was clearly in danger and was evacuating. I used to say that out of pure laziness, because I had come from 26, I was already on 11. I'm like, I need to go down 11 more and go back up 15. I'm just going to keep going. But the more I think about that, the more I think it maybe was providential, right? Maybe that was what I was meant to do. I went to the basement of that building. I don't know if you had ever been to the World Trade Center complex, but there was this whole subterranean labyrinth of shops and tunnels. And I was going to the PATH train. In my simple head, I'm like, I'll just get on the train and go home, right? I go down to the PATH train. It's filled with thick, black, acrid smoke, which is obvious because the flames of One World Trade are funneling down into the breezeway. And it's only when I come back upstairs to the lobby that I decide, again, I don't know where I'm going. I just know that this isn't the place to be. And I think about that. And I used to think it was luck. I used to think it was serendipity. But the older that I've gotten, and I hopefully the wiser, I have no desire to go back to it. I think all of that is a sign that says, this wasn't the path that I needed you to be on. This is your wake-up call to get on this other path. because I need you to do something in this world before you, before your time is up. That's the way I view all that. But when you mention serendipity and luck, that's what comes to mind. You talk about your books, a couple of things here. So on page 40, you talk about ladder burners are restless explorers, unencumbered by convention. What the outside world sees as bouncing around, they describe as curiosity. They embark upon the world of work, knowing that their first job is not their last. They pick up bits and pieces of learnings and what interests them from jobs, assignments, and people they meet. What I hope is obvious after I've chatted with you this morning is that I read that and I'm like, that's me, right? I am not a wandering soul in this world. I am not aimless. I simply have a general direction that sometimes is just the polar opposite of what I'm doing, right? I've been doing technology my whole life. I've been doing different bits and pieces because I've just been curious. I've just been an intellectually curious person that says, I don't know anything about that. So yeah, that sounds good. And the interviews are always interesting when I interview for these companies because it's like what you know. This reminds me of your friend Kelly that you just talked about. You know, contacts build relationships. Relationship building is your job. This task you perform are only what you do. The change in priority could turn your to-do list upside down. That is my life. That's the reason we're talking is I've made a relationship with folks like Diana, again, completely remotely, which going back to luck, maybe that's serendipitous. Maybe it's not. Maybe Diana was on my path.
So look where she started. She wasn't anywhere near University of Pennsylvania.
I know. And that's what I think is fascinating. I've said this to my kids, Alan. I think the challenge, there's many challenges in this life, but I think the biggest one is we obviously have to live life day to day. But we can only understand it looking backwards. And for people that don't take the time to think about that, I think they're just missing out on so much of what life can offer. They are alive, but they are not living. They are not becoming, in Maslow's terms, the fully self-actualized version of themselves.
Yeah.
The one work I didn't talk about, which was hugely impactful on me, and I wrote about it in a book I wrote, I talked about it in my TED Talk, was Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning.
Oh, of course.
I've read it so many times. I read it as a philosophy student. I read it in the days after 9/11. I read it in the class that Diana was in when I was a student in that class. And I've read it three times since teaching that class with Janet Greco. And every time I read it, I get something different from it. But there's a quote that hangs on my wall. You can't see it from where I'm sitting. It says, "For happiness like success cannot be pursued. It must ensue." And I read that every day. And I think about it. And I'm like, you know what? Like Will Smith was not right. This is not the pursuit of happiness, right? You cannot, like happiness to me is contentment. And it only comes on January 16, 2024, because of all the crap that I've been through, because of that roller coaster and because of those ups and downs. But I am content with where I am today. And I focus more of my time in life on relationship building than I do on asset building or financial statement building. It's just not important to me like it used to be. It just really isn't. You talk about impact on page 82 of your book. And this is a piece that resonated with me. Ironically, I'm reading your book. The time I was reading your book, going full circle again, my current employer offers tuition reimbursement. So I said, okay, what have I not done yet? So I enrolled at a class at Stanford in their exec ed program on design thinking. So the big thing I learned at Stanford is empathy. So it's empathetic listening, the importance of empathy. And I reflect on my life. You mentioned my wife earlier. The one thing my wife does in droves is empathy. I always say that she has forgotten more about empathy than I have ever learned. So she is the perfect yin to my yang. And I think together we are the perfect pair to raise kids with a conscience and kids that are going to hopefully do right in this world. And that's how we could talk to
them. Oh, that's wonderful. I have an observation to make. I think you have an incredible ability to integrate and synthesize and reflect about more the meaning and purpose. You're a explorer. You're probably a tinkerer too, trying to figure out how things are. I wonder when all that becomes you. It's not a matter of trying to distinguish yourself from the pack. There's just something, Dan, it chipping away at something. You could leave technology tomorrow. What do you want to get into? You want to get on the bridge? That's concretely what I would tell people. That's what I would tell your kids. Look, you get to this point, build a base. You have to have credibility. You can like it, not like it. You have to be good at something and you have to know how to build relationships. Keep your head down and work on it. Now let's talk about how you build bridge, how you get there. You want to climb the ladder? Listen, your son wants to make a lot of money. My point is, I don't know what it is. I do know what it is. I know exactly what it is. It's the castle factor.
I'm gonna write that down. I'm gonna give you credit when I use that in the future.
That's what it is. And the world will listen to you, Dan Castle. You just resonate at a different frequency. Does that make any sense?
It does. And I appreciate your kindness in saying that. One of the methods I've used is something that I stumbled on actually when I was preparing for one of my lessons with Janet, which was something called Rolf's reflective model. I don't know if you're familiar with this model. It's three simple principles. It asks the following questions, someone, meaning usually yourself, hence the reflective nature. And it's what, so what, and now what? Before I read about this model, I spent a lot of time in that triangle of thinking without knowing that it was called that. Sometimes to the point, and my wife, I love her dearly. And again, we're great compliments to each other, but sometimes she's, you got to get out of your own head. I know. I just don't know where the door is. I don't know where the window is. I'm in the thick of it right now. And to me, her name is Marissa. And I said, Marissa, that is the now what. You and I think are being great role models for our kids, that the fact that learning is a process. It never ends. And second, it's not just about what you're doing. It's about what you want to do and then building that bridge, to use your terms, Alan, of how do I get there? And you never get there by yourself. You always need to rely on other people. Right. And once you get there, wherever there is, don't be afraid to turn around and help everybody else across the same bridge.
This is it for me. I had to have some level of practicality about people wanting to know, doctor, what is it that I have to do? And I got to creating meaning. This is pretty funny. It starts on page 87 and it ends on page 90. Creating meaning. Come on. It's the shortest chapter in the book. What? I didn't know what else to say.
I don't think you can say meaning.
I don't think you can.
No.
You can't. I think it's really funny. There's one young fella that just read the book and he's all over it. And I appreciate that. He's in graduate school. Everybody should read this book. He said, and the great thing is it's a quick read. You can read this in 3.5 hours, one sitting. And I'm thinking, shit, did I give him enough?
I think you have given them enough. And one thing I will offer to you, Alan, I'm going to give this book to each of my kids, starting with my oldest son, who's on this precipice of going off into his own world. And I'm going to ask him as a favor, as his father, to read this book and tell me what he's learned from it. I will give you that feedback.
That'd be wonderful.
Because this is a kid who's in the very beginning. He's down. If this is the bridge, if this is the ladder, he's here. Right?
Yeah.
And I'm hopeful. And as soon as I read this cover, by the way, I thought of, as a child, I thought of Chutes and Ladders as the game.
Yeah.
Right. And I thought of the game. How ironic is it that even in that game, the goal is to get here. It's to climb to the top. My TED talk, by the way, is called The Paradox of Climbing Deeper.
Oh, please. Come on. Isn't that a riot?
But I start off that talk by saying motivational features, and this is like my pathology from having memorized this TED talk, motivational posters that feature mountains have us believe that climbing higher and higher is the only way to reach success.
Yeah.
But I think it's wrong. I think it's all about climbing deeper. It's in the valleys of despair that we find our true meaning, not in the tops that are limited and transitory success. That's what's in this book. And that's what my children have been forced to watch my TED talk. Two of them saw it live. The other two watched the recording of it because that's what dads do. They make
they don't have a choice. You don't have to apologize.
And my one son, this is my book. My one son read my book. The other kids have not read their copy yet, but he's the one that I have the most interesting conversations with because he understands this is basically my life in this book. And it's a lot of the story I just told you. I appreciate you writing this book. I appreciate you making time for this conversation. And I think the Patterson factor may be that you might want to put a disclaimer in the book. Say, look, you may quit your job after you read this book, and that's not my fault.
Warning.
That's right. I'm going to give you the what, and I'm going to give you the so what, but the now what is totally on you.
On you. So great to meet you.
You too, Alan. I appreciate it.
Well, that's going to do it for today.
What an enjoyable discussion. Brilliant guy, Dan Castle. I'm sure we'll hear more from him in the future. Come join us again. Ladder Burners Unite. This is Alan Patterson.